terms of parliamentary rules, we need to elect a standing chairperson. So can I call for any nominations from members? Honorable Yenge.
Yeah, I move that we have the chairperson in the name of my honorable Mamila.
Thank you. So, Ms. Adams, you second that? Thank you. Ms. Vidla.
Thank you, honorable members, and good morning, and welcome back from, I don't want to say holiday, a recess, but those who managed to have a holiday, I hope they had a good time with their families and come back here more revived. And those who are busy with constituency work, congratulations for the work you have done wherever you were deployed. I also welcome National Treasury and SARS delegation led by Mr. Ron van der Merwe and National Treasury, Mr. Luthando. You are most welcome. Honorable members, the agenda, I think it's before you. Today we're dealing with matters relating to double taxation agreements. And I will now hand over to both National Treasury and SARS to lead us. We have prepared this program, but if you feel that it doesn't suit your preparations in terms of the presentation, you are free to change it. Anyhow, we are in your hands. So you can cluster your items in whatever way you feel comfortable. Thank you. And over to you, Mr. van der Merwe.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. In terms of the draft program, what we thought would probably work best in presenting to your committee was the first block that we would deal with is the block with Seychelles, Malaysia and Austria. Malaysia and Austria are merely exchange of information updates. The second block would be the six tax information exchange agreements with Guernsey, Cayman Islands, Jersey, San Marino, that group, because they're all virtually the same. And those are all for formal ratification, Chair. The third block would then be Costa Rica, Dominica, and Argentina, which are tax information exchange agreements, also the same. Block four would be, right at the bottom, Norway and Turkey, which are just exchange of information. And then block five would be Senegal, which is a full double taxation agreement which Treasury and SARS have just finished negotiating. That's a preliminary hearing. And block six would be the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters, which is a multilateral, and there we will also do a fuller presentation, if that's okay with you, Chair. Thank you. I would ask my colleague Luthando to talk on Seychelles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From National Treasury's point of view, we only have two presentations. One is for the formal ratification of Seneca of Seychelles, and the last one is preliminary presentation in respect of Senegal double tax agreement. I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if you'd like us to do both presentations, or you'd want us to do Seychelles first, and then later on do Senegal. On our side, we'd prefer doing both presentations at the same time and finish. Thank you, Chair. As indicated, our presentation will only be limited to the ratification of Seychelles Protocol and Senegal Double Tax Agreement. The other presentation in respect of multilateral convention on assistance in exchange of information and other agreements will be done by SARS. We are not involved. Those are just administrative agreements between revenue authorities. Turning to the presentation on Seychelles. This is one of the tax treaties that had to be renegotiated before the minister could implement a new dividends tax. The reason why it had to be renegotiated, it had a zero rate on withholding tax on dividends. And therefore, if it was left as it is, it would open a big loophole for tax avoidance. The other tax treaties that we renegotiated, the other nine, four of them, the UK, Sweden, Ireland, Australia, and Netherlands, have already been ratified. Australia and Netherlands are already in operation. The outstanding tax treaties are Oman, Cyprus, and Malta, and we'll be, in a few months' time, we'll be coming back to the committee for their ratification. They are just in a process of being signed. The Seychelles protocol was signed on 4 April this year, and the minister, as you would remember, in his budget speech, indicated that he would like to implement the dividend tax on the 1st of April next year, 2012. And that's the end of our presentation in respect of the Seychelles, Madam Chair. Moving to Senegal, it's a preliminary hearing. It's a full double tax agreement. My colleague, Mr. Charles Mangola, will be assisting me in doing this presentation. But the reason for the negotiation of this new treaty was to expand our tax treaty into the West Africa. At the moment, we have two treaties in the West African region. And Senegal is the fifth largest trading partner of South Africa in the West African region. Mr. Mangola will take over from here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much, Lutando. With your permission, Madam Chair, I will proceed to outline a few aspects relating to the proposed double taxation agreement between Senegal and South Africa. The two countries, we on a bilateral relation, we are joint members of the NEPAD steering committee, and there is currently an existing bilateral investment protection agreement that has been entered to. It has been signed, but it has not been ratified. That falls within the jurisdiction of the Department of Trade and Industry. The trade and investment relationship between these two countries, on a trade side, the data from the DTI indicate a favorable trade balance, and the flows between the period 2005 to 2010 indicate a steady increase, albeit we're not going to be talking to those figures, but we have taken note of those figures, and they do indicate a favorable trade balance, meaning we are exporting more to Senegal than we are importing from them. Unfortunately, we also don't have the data on the investment flows between the relevant countries. Our investment data is kept by the South African Reserve Bank. However, currently we don't have that information updated. However, we have noted from the South African Embassy in the Senegal that some of the companies which are invested in Senegal will include South African Airways, which flies down there, STS, Nando's, Eskom, SAB Miller, MultiChoice, Hodefco, and Baker Company. We also have an increasing investment in the mining sector with your gold, Anglo Gold Ashanti, Rand Gold, and Goldstone, and Mori Gold. So there is some investment opportunities that South African businesses are exploiting in the Senegal, and we have taken that into account as well in negotiating this double taxation agreement. Why do we need a treaty with Senegal? At the core of this double taxation agreement is indeed to enhance trade and investment between South Africa and Senegal. Treaties, as you'll know, Madam Speaker, provide a fiscal stability by means of capping withholding taxes. And they facilitate investment by creating the certainty. If you eliminate double taxation agreement, then business can go in freely knowing what is the tax status or what will their tax cost be. There is also an assurance of non-discrimination. Treaties also provide non-discrimination in a tax sense. So a businessman that goes invest in Senegal or a businessman from Senegal that comes to South Africa will know that he will not be treated differently from other investors in that particular country, or he will not be treated differently from the residents of that particular country. Once again, the treaty provides cooperation in tax matters. These reduce opportunities for tax avoidance and evasion. RON is the competent authority in South Africa, is involved in the mechanisms for dispute resolutions, and treaties provide a framework for him to fulfill that role. And this particular treaty will once again also provide that mechanism. Most importantly, from a treasury point of view, is what we term the Gateway into Africa initiative. The House has heard on numerous occasions that South Africa is the natural gateway into the continent. There are obviously other countries that see themselves as gateway into the continent. However, we see ourselves, because of the physical infrastructure, the financial infrastructure that's in place in South Africa, as a natural gateway into Africa. And we have, for the past several years, been trying to align our tax provisions with that particular goal. And we have put in place a mechanism from a tax perspective that enables people to establish headquarter companies in South Africa that will manage or that will run their investment into the rest of the continent. And Senegal is our expansion on those provisions. So we see investors, not only from South Africa, but investors from elsewhere around the world, setting up in South Africa in order to exploit opportunities that are available in Senegal. Similarly, on an investment fund, we have set up, on the domestic side, we have set up what we call regional investment regime that enables fund managers and fund administrators to be located in South Africa, hopefully to move away to return those who went to London. As Madam Chair will know, most of the South African fund managers are based there. You know, come back to South Africa and manage their funds from South Africa into the rest of the continent. This is a simple map of the West African region. The 15 members make up the ECOWAS, except for Mauritania. How we exposed our treaty network in that region is mainly at the current moment in Nigeria and in Ghana. And both are indeed gateways into those particular regions. And we are expanding our network into Senegal further upwards in the southern region. This small table here indicates what was particularly important for us in order to achieve the gateway into Africa. Because what it tells us what we're getting relative or comparative to others in Senegal. Tax is a business expenditure, Madam Chair, and if you don't have a competitive advantage, you know, business is likely to divert to other countries that most likely have better treaty regime or better treaty rates. As I indicated in my introduction, a tax treaty tries to provide fiscal stability. It is negotiated on the basis that business will move from South Africa into Senegal to invest. But in practice, that's not how business works. Business will always look to lower their costs. So if there is a way to lower their costs, they will restructure their entity structure in a way that will lower that cost. In this instance, what this table shows us, and the red highlighted thing, it shows us that if you get dividends from if you are a Mauritian company and you get dividends from Senegal, those dividends will not be taxed, so there will be zero tax. If you get interest from Senegal, you will not pay tax. If you get royalties from Senegal, you will not be taxed. These are the core business income flows. However, if you get dividends in terms of the proposed DTA, if you get dividends and as a South African, you will be taxed at 5% if you're a bank. I mean, if it's a substantial interest in that particular business, or if it's normal your portfolio dividends, then you'll be taxed at 10%. If you receive interest, you will be taxed at 10%, but we also have what we call the most favored nation provision, meaning that if Senegal negotiates or enters into any double taxation agreement with any other country, which double taxation agreement provides a most favorable provision than ours, they will again engage in negotiation. The same applies to royalties. That is not an ideal situation, and during negotiation, we have indicated that Mauritius is just next to us. There is no reason for anybody to set up in South Africa and incur those costs if he might not be able to pay any taxes if he establishes via Mauritius. And if you look at the other treaty partners, we relatively have better rates. We have, I mean, Canada has got 16%. Italy and France got 15% on dividends and interest and royalties. So we're relatively in a better advantage. But in order for us to be a true gateway into Africa, we must be in a situation where we're not disadvantaged. And this we're looking into. The Senegalese have indicated to us that they are reconsidering that DTA with the 0% on dividends, interest, and royalties. And following that, as you'll see in my later slides, we will review our position on the Senegalese. I've further put in Ghana, for instance. If you look at Ghana, we comparable to most of the partners that go into Ghana. So business, there's no unfair international competitiveness. So business go into Ghana on an equal footing, both from Belgium, France, Italy, Netherlands, and South Africa. The rates are comparable. Sometimes we got a better rate. For instance, on the interest, we got 5 and 8%. And on the royalties, we got 8%. So we're better than France, we're better than Belgium there. So that puts us in a much better position. We're better than the UK. So most businesses, let's say investors from the UK, can as well set up their operations in South Africa and get exposure to that lower fiscal stability in their investment into Ghana. The same happens with Nigeria. And all of these are West African states. We're relatively comparable. We're on par with everyone else. The game is played on an equal footing. You got 10% and 7.5 on dividends and 7.5 again on interest and royalties. That is on par with your China, which is the custodian of major capital at the current moment. And we're kind of sitting in a better position than any other treaty partner with Nigeria. So having outlined all of this, what is the way forward from a policy perspective? Today we have a preliminary hearing. the 10th of October. And as I indicated, Senegal will be re-looking into the double taxation agreement policy framework, and they will be advising us. Depending on the outcome of that review, we might consider, or we may consider, delaying either the ratification or the signing of the double taxation agreement, pending that review by Senegal. All we need, Madam Speaker, and the position that we're negotiating from when we entered Senegal, was we are a natural gateway into the continent. We want to be on par with everyone else. We don't want to add unnecessary business costs to doing business between the two relevant countries. Hence, this policy position. We're not promoting ourselves as a tax haven. We're not a tax haven. Every company in South Africa pays tax. There is no special tax dispensation per se that relates to foreigners, except for the HQ regime, which is money, which is what I can call hot money anyway, which is money which wouldn't have come otherwise in South Africa. Hence, we have provided a flow through. So we're saying that the Senegalese will be looking into their position, and pending that, we might come to for ratification, or we might advise the minister to delay the signing of the double taxation agreement. I thank you, Madam Speaker, and the House.
Thank you, Mr. Mvovo and Mr. Makola. Honourable members, any comments on the proposed amendments on the Seychelles protocol? Yes, honourable member. Van Rooyen.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me start by welcoming the two brief presentations. Chair, mine is just a very general question. In view of the fact that we are currently faced with an economy that is gradually contracting, and as a result, our GDP projections have to be reviewed. I'm not sure this determination of rates as we conclude, or maybe as we deal with this the double taxation process, to what extent are they taking that into consideration? Of course, in taking into consideration what you have just said about the need of South Africa to be competitive, I just want to check how do you relate determination of rates to our growth that is not doing that well economically. And obviously, as you are all aware, we might have to review, our projections, very soon. So I'm not sure how do you take that into consideration when you make determination of these rates. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Van Rooyen. Further comments, Honourable Members? Honourable Mahlamini.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is just going to be a very... I need a better understanding. You know, if you remember that the Minister has actually pronounced that we will implement the dividend tax by 2012. And I'm sure you're also aware that SARS has lost a case with MTN as far as where MTN took SARS to court, and the court ruled in favor of the MTN, where it was about the fees, taxation, the staff, whatever training, and the court actually said it was wrong for the commissioner to disallow the deductions, tax deductions of the MTN, because when we look at our act as such, the dividends, it was not well explained as to what needs to be done. That's how I read the whole article. Now, having said that, I am asking myself, these tweets that we listen and look at them, and then we say we still have to renegotiate, we still to go and do the ratification. Does it take the consideration, any consideration of the loopholes of the double taxation vis-a-vis the dividends that we have to post as the treasury. I don't know if do you get me? Oh, I'm a bit ambiguous. I don't know. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I didn't see any hand, so I will hand over to National Treasury to respond to those two.
Our colleague Ron indicated you'd like to make a further comment, maybe perhaps before we'll take it. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll start with the issue on the loopholes and the we're not necessarily converse with the MTN case, Madam Mazamin, yes, has alluded to. However, South Africa has migrated from the secondary tax on companies into the new dividends tax regime, meaning that the incidence of tax is a bit different. Whereas in the past we taxed companies, now we're going to tax the shareholders. It is still relatively the same rate, but now it's taxing the hands of the shareholders. So it's no longer a business expense; it's the cost of investment by the shareholders. And it is precisely because of the previous zero dividend tax rate that we had to renegotiate some of the strategic double taxation agreement so that we can close the loopholes. Because with a zero rate, what we were going to have, we were going to have all the dividends flowing out of South Africa tax-free. So the renegotiation, some of the rates are 5%. And things like that. So we said we'll rather have the 5% of the dividends going outside than getting nothing at all. So it was indeed intended to close those loopholes there. Some loopholes obviously still exist on the interest articles. But that's in respect of the other treaties, and we're re-looking into that, and we will be initiating a project to particularly deal with that. So as the National Treasury, we are committed to indeed closing any loopholes, either through domestic legislation or through our double taxation agreements. However, one obviously needs to take into account that most of these double taxation agreements were negotiated when the fiscal policy was in a particular manner. For instance, on the interest side, at some point at the dawn of democratic dispensation, meant that we wanted all that foreign money coming into South Africa, and we had to encourage them and tie them somehow, so we never taxed the interest. But we have since moved away from that position, and we're relatively comfortable as a country, and most people, the international market has shown confidence in our markets, and hence we now starting to, in 2013 or so, we might be starting to impose tax on the interest.
Sorry, Madam Chair, can I just quickly do the follow-up, because it is still not clear. Because you're not versed with the case I'm talking about. The case I'm talking about is based on the very same loophole that you're trying to clarify, where us as government or as Treasury, if we made it sure that the double taxation includes the interest, includes other services, I'm sure at the end of the day, we are going to get more than 5%. The case was, the MTN, if you know, it operates in all Africa, in the SADC, in the whole SADC. And now we are seeing SAB Miller going to the Senegalese. We are seeing Nando's going to the Senegalese. Do you understand what I'm saying? But on the same note, as Treasury, we haven't tried and stopped that gap, and we are still believing that 5% is good enough for the country. If you look at that case, you will see how much the SARS has lost, because the judge has given 50% deduction on that audit, tax audit. That's what I'm saying, because the SARS is saying, the commissioner is saying, I'm disallowing you for any deductions on those audits, things that you are claiming. Okay? And this is what I'm saying. So that's what I'm saying. There is a delay. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe honourable members, so that we are able to follow the discussions properly. Let's first deal with the Seychelles proposed amendments. And then move to the next one, and then be specific and relate our comments on what has been proposed by National Treasury, and later on we can engage on general matters in relation to the double taxation. Is that agreed to? So that we make the lives of National Treasury much easier. Anything on the proposed amendments on the Seychelles Protocol? Agreed.
No, I will move the proposal based on the renegotiation that needs to be done, and maybe get the time frames when those renegotiations are going to be done.
Okay. National Treasury, you still have time to clarify some of the issues on the Seychelles Protocol. But as the committee, we will still have time alone to engage on these issues and respond to National Treasury through the Speaker's office. But if you still have anything that you want to add on your presentation, you are most welcome to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify one thing. The renegotiation has been done and completed. The only issue that was outstanding was the signature. The minister delayed bringing dividends tax into operation because we wanted all the tax treaties that have a zero rate on dividends to be renegotiated so that there's no loophole. The negotiations have been done, and by the time the minister implements dividends tax, we think by then the treaties would be in operation. So the possibility of a loophole on dividends tax will not exist by then. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe coming to the honourable member's question on the link between the rate and the double tax and the GDP. We haven't drawn that link per se. The lower rates take into account the fact that these taxes we're talking about are taxes on gross. So, you know, you receive 100, we take 10, or you receive 100, we take 5. So we're not saying you receive 100, you can deduct the expenses, and then we tax you on the net. Hence, you have those lower. Otherwise, the cost of investment will be unbearable for business. Hence, this rate. And these are naturally the standard rates that you find internationally. I think Mr. Lutano has clarified the aspect on the deduction of possibly audit fees. I think I have an idea. Madam Dlamini, the case she's referring to. If I can just add one point there, it's that we don't allow companies to deduct in South Africa the cost of their doing business overseas. So the South African economy from a tax perspective is ring-fenced. So we're saying you can't take foreign losses and bring them over into the country and wipe out your taxable income in South Africa. So if, for instance, you have a company operating in South Africa and through a subsidiary in Senegal, the losses that it incurs in Senegal cannot be set off against the income they make in South Africa. However, if they make income there, they will be taxed on a gross basis. We will also continue to tax them in South Africa, but give them a credit for the taxes that they've paid. So there will be a residual tax that is payable in South Africa. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You want to add something? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Just three brief comments in relation to
The first question from the Honourable Member and the question you raised, plus the follow-up, if I may. I think in relation to the first question, we need to just stress that these double taxation agreements are there to make, to put us in a competitive position in relation to other countries which are in some cases competing to invest in South Africa, and in other cases where we are looking to invest in a continent such as Africa, for argument's sake. And when you're competitive, if you're looking at inward flows, it would create more foreign direct investment, or the potential to have more foreign direct investment in South Africa. And it's that foreign direct investment which helps with the growth of the economy. And once you get that growth of economy, then there's the potential, if it's the right kind of investment, to grow jobs. And then we can increase the tax base. If we don't draw investment, then I'm afraid 10% of zero remains zero. So you need to just grow that base, and this whole double taxation agreement is an instrument which tries to make a more favourable investment destination. Sorry, I got a bit of jet lag and my tongue's got tied, but that's what I wanted to say. With regard to MTN, I just wanted to say that it goes, I think that case, if I got it right, and if I didn't, well, I'll be told, no doubt. But it goes about deduction. And as my colleagues have pointed out, domestic law deals with that. And the treaty deals only with taxing rights. With regard to deduction, and with regard to anti-abuse provisions to stop loopholes, nothing in the treaty stops you applying your domestic law. So your domestic law is the instrument which will say what deductions are allowable, and secondly, is there to address abusive practices from taxpayers' side. And your domestic law will reign supreme in relation to that, because nothing in a treaty will stop you applying your domestic law to deductions and abuses. And then finally also, I think what we are trying to do is encouraging our own companies also to invest into Africa. I think that's a focus of Treasury policy. So I don't think we should look at it as them leaving, but merely that doing business through subsidiary companies in other countries, and we would expect the dividend flow back to the holding companies in South Africa, and that I think is the whole intention of the Treasury policy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ron. Thank you to National Treasury for your brief presentation. And as I said earlier on, that the committee will meet on its own and engage on these matters. The report will be forwarded to you through the natural processes of Parliament. Thank you very much. Mr. Ron, we're coming to you now. If you can start by introducing your team. There are new faces that we have not met before in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I guess when you say introduce the team because they're new faces, you're not including Cindy.
No, that's part of our furniture.
That's what I thought. On my right is, I've got two managers on this section here, Oshna Maharaj and Shelly-Ann Carrera behind me. And coming up later in the customs is another of my team, Tando Kolo Twala. Thank you, Chair. So if I could then just go back to Seychelles, because that's the one for formal ratification. The ones that we've dealt with there... Are you with me? Perfect. Go. The relevant articles that we've changed in this protocol are, firstly, we've updated the definition of resident of a contracting state. This is an important definition because the benefits of a treaty will apply only to people who are your tax residents. So the first treaty with Seychelles was negotiated when we still had a source system of taxation and we didn't have a proper definition of resident. That has changed since 2000, and therefore we are now in a position as a residence-based taxation state to follow the international definition in these treaties of what is a resident, and this we've done in this particular agreement. We have also, in Article 5, it's a definition of permanent establishment. Permanent establishment is the threshold which must be crossed before business profits can be taxed in a state. We've extended this definition to include the performance of professional services and other activities of an independent character by individuals when they're in our country for any period of 183 days in any 12-month period. So just bottom line is we're saying that individuals who are engaged in professional work, such as doctors or lawyers or engineers as such, who are not our residents, if they come to our country and they're in our country performing those services for more than 183 days in any 12-month period, then we have the right to tax them. Of course, this is a bilateral treaty, so it applies equally to our professionals who would be going to the other country and would be rendering services. They would only become taxable there if their presence was more than 183 days in any 12-month period. Article 10, dealing with dividends, is the one that my colleagues from Treasury have focused on. That takes away the zero rate, which was there in the old treaty, and replaces it with the South African position, which we currently follow, and that is that dividends leaving a country, in other words, from a company resident in your country, will be taxed at 5% if the shareholding is at least 10%, and in respect to portfolio, 10% on all other dividends. That's the dividend article. We also modernized the article dealing with capital gains. There again, when we first negotiated this treaty, we didn't have capital gains tax in South Africa. So what we've done is follow the international approach by making movable business assets now completely taxable in the state in which those movable business assets are situated, such as when it forms part of a permanent establishment in your state. Also, we've included a new paragraph 4 which says that gains derived by a resident of a contracting state from the alienation of shares which derive more than 50% of their value directly or indirectly from immovable property, that gain may be taxed in the state where the immovable property is situated. And all we're trying to achieve there, Chair, is that the normal principle is a capital gain in respect of immovable property should always be taxable in the state in which the immovable property is situated. That's source, and that's the principle that we all follow. So what happens if the immovable property is owned by a company? Because then all you have to do is sell the shares. This provision says if the value of those shares is created more than 50% by immovable property in your state, then you have the right to tax the gain on the sale of the shares. And that's what you could almost call a little bit of an anti-abuse provision. We deleted Article 14 of the old treaty, which previously dealt with independent personal services, because we now deal with that under the enlarged definition under Article 5, which I've dealt with, and therefore instead of calling it independent personal services, we simply say these people earn business income, and that business income should be taxable immediately you have a permanent establishment in your country. That's why we extended the definition of permanent establishment in Article 5. While we were busy with this as well. This is one of the countries where, or jurisdictions where, we were particularly interested in getting proper access to exchange of information. And therefore, we negotiated, and Seychelles agreed to include a new article on exchange of information, which is absolutely in line with the OECD model. As we've said on numerous occasions, this article ensures that they cannot use bank secrecy to deny us access to information, and they cannot also say that although they have no domestic tax, that if they have no domestic tax interest, that they can then refuse to give us information which we request. Broad terms, what we're saying is, if I go to you as a country and I say I want information on my taxpayer in respect of this or that asset, and that country says, but I have no domestic tax interest, why should I give you that? Why should I get it for you? That cannot be used as an excuse anymore. The treaty specifically says, even if you have no domestic tax interest, you will use the full powers of your law to get me that information. And both of those issues, the bank secrecy and the domestic tax interest, are really big improvements which have helped us in many occasions to get information which we require to, shall I say, address the affairs of some of our taxpayers. And that's all I wanted to say on Seychelles. The other two small protocols which are also up for formal ratification, Chair, and which Treasury has not handled, are those with Malaysia and Austria, which are also part of this. And of course the reason why they haven't made a presentation here is that it's solely with regard to exchange of information. And in both of those treaties, exactly what I've said in relation to Seychelles, we've now agreed with both Malaysia and Austria that we should have the fully updated exchange of information article, which, amongst other things, does away with bank secrecy and the need for a domestic tax interest. It puts us in line with the very latest approach internationally, and hopefully will be a better tool for SARS to use in chasing taxpayers whose affairs are cross-border. So those are the only comments that we would have, Chair, in relation to the Seychelles protocol and the protocols with Malaysia and Austria. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ron. Honourable members, comments on the three presentations? Honourable Madlamin.
I do agree with the majority of the amendments or the ratification. But I would like the clarity on Article number 10. Can you further clarify for me? You are saying it's a 5% for shareholding of at least 10%. 10% of what? Of the dividend? Or 10% of the total sum of the dividends, and then you say then 10% of all others. Now I'm sure it's because this is the summary, and because it's the summary, you assume we understand. So can I just get a clarity on that, okay? And lastly, Chair, having said that, if I go to Article 13, capital gains, and you go to bullet number 2, where we are saying, then from the gains derived by residents of a 50% of their value, directly or indirectly, from the immobile. So, and then apply that if you respond to what I've just asked as a clarity on Article number 10. Because it's still talking about the shareholding on the other side. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Further comments? Honourable George.
Thank you, Chairperson.
I just wanted to ask a question
relating to the Seychelles, but with reference also to the agreement on the Cayman Islands. Now, I know there's a big issue about sharing information between jurisdictions, and you were talking about the fact that if we were looking for information, that there wouldn't be any impediments to getting that information. But I'm looking at the Cayman Island one, for example, and there's a section under number 4. I know that they're not related because obviously all the agreements are different, but it talks about that, the party shall not be required to obtain and provide information which, if the requested information was within the jurisdiction of the requesting party, the competent authority of the requesting party would not be able to obtain under its laws in the normal course of something. Okay, I will ask you when you get to the Cayman, but I'm just asking in context of the Seychelles, is that, is there any way that if we ask for information, we are not going to be able to get it because it's not gettable in that jurisdiction? Thanks, Jacobs.
Thank you, Honorable George. Sam, do you want to respond now?
Thank you, Chair. If I could deal with the second question first. It looks at a situation where simply that information is not within your jurisdiction and is unobtainable in your jurisdiction. What we're looking at in the Seychelles, and you're absolutely correct in saying that they're different kinds of agreements. One is more limited than what we have with the Seychelles, for argument's sake, but with your permission, I probably speak more about that when I deal with Guernsey and those agreements, because they are more limited. But what we have with the Seychelles is the full OECD/United Nations Exchange of Information article, and that makes it very clear that if you have entered into this agreement, you have an obligation to share with us all the information that you are able to get under your laws. And you cannot use the excuse of bank secrecy as an impediment to obtaining that information, be it ownership, be it whatever. You may not use that. And you may also not use the excuse of, it's not my domestic tax interest. I have no domestic tax interest, therefore I'm not going to use my laws to get that information. This is based also on the fact that states are required to meet this standard of exchange. And in terms of the peer review which is currently going on in the Global Forum on Exchange of Information, they have to ensure that their domestic law is such that they're able to get all of the information that we require and, in fact, to exchange it. And if they don't do it, I can assure the member that they get roasted in their peer reviews. So there's been a really positive change to this whole approach. If I could turn to the first question. Yes, I'm sorry, I was unnecessarily brief. With Article 10, What we have is a dual rate of withholding tax limitations imposed in the source state. When I talk about the source state, I'm talking about the state where the company which is paying the dividends is a resident. And what we're trying to do is to encourage bigger investments, so that if you invest in a company in my country and your shareholding is in excess of 10%, you own more than 10% of the shares, which, as we know, in big companies, that's a lot of money, or can be a lot of money, I will give you a better rate of withholding. So if you own more than 10% of my shares, I will reduce my withholding tax to 5% of the gross amount of the dividend. However, if your shareholding is less than 10%, I will then take 10% gross on all the dividends which you earn. That's what I should have said with relation to Article 10, and I apologize. With regard to the second bullet point on capital gains, I'm not looking at a situation there of the amount of the shareholding. We're looking at a situation there that in relation to those shares of the property owning company, we have to do a calculation and say what creates the value of those shares. And if the value of those shares is created more than 50% by immovable property in my state, then I want to say when you sell those shares, I want to tax the profit, because the value, more than 50% of the value, is created by immovable property in my country. And the international principle is immovable property, when you're selling it, then you should have the right to tax it. After all, it's your immovable property. Tax lawyers haven't been able to move that yet, but I guess they're working on it. So it just follows that very sound principle relating to the taxation of immovable property. And it looks at addressing the situation where often the immovable property is in a company, and they don't sell the immovable property, they just sell the shares. So the test is then what creates the value of the shares. And if it's more than 50%, well, then I have the right of taxation. I could just mention that, in fact, what we have in the treaties gives us a right which goes beyond our domestic law, because I think domestic law talks about 80%, that the value should be more than 80% by immovable property before we will tax that. That's what domestic law says. And because a treaty does not impose taxation, we would only impose it, therefore, in accordance with domestic law. But we, if the domestic law changes, we can follow it as far as 50% is concerned. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Mahlamin.
Thank you, Chair. So is the official actually saying to us then the immovable property becomes the part and the parcel of the business property of the business, or yes, of the business of the business as such, because there was that separation with previously before the ratification. Are we saying that now?
Chair, with your permission, what I'm saying is, in the previous treaty, we did not address the situation, and in fact, any gain on the sale of shares under the old treaty would have been taxable only in the state of residence of the seller of those shares. But we're now saying, hang on a second, if the value is created by immovable property in my state, you could be sitting in your country selling these shares, but the value is the immovable property. We want a right to tax. Is that
covered? Okay, thank you. Can we then take the next group of protocols? Mr.
Sorry, Chair, you satisfied with the explanation on Malaysia and Austria then? No further.
Yes, I think honourable members are satisfied. Which ones are we taking, Mr. Ron? The Bermuda one.
We see the formal ratification of those six.
Okay.
Tax information exchange is starting from Thursday and then.
Okay. Honourable members, we have all those documents.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, as I started saying a little bit earlier, this is a little bit different to the article that we were able to include in our double taxation agreements, because this whole agreement, the tax information exchange agreement, which I would call just TIA for sake of brevity, these TIAs have nothing with regard to taxing rights at all. We enter into TIAs with countries with whom there's no real need to have a double taxation agreement, and probably the first reason is that there's very little chance of double taxation arising because they don't have too much in the way of taxation. So why our interest in these countries is simply that for most of these countries which you see before you, Chair, they were countries which would have had bank secrecy and all of those provisions in the past, which meant that if our taxpayers were able to invest their money in those countries, SARS had very little chance of being able to get any information in relation to that income. And, well, if you don't have information, you're pretty much fighting your fight with your hands tied behind your back. Or perhaps you might have Bryce Lawrence as a referee. But either way, you're going to come second. So, as we said in the preliminary briefing on these tiers, Chair, this has been a really important step forward for revenue authorities. And I said at the time, I trust it's not the final step, because a double taxation agreement allows us to exchange information not only on request but spontaneously, automatically. It looks to create a forum for cross-border audits or tax examinations, whatever you would want to call it. It's a really good approach, but the TIA allows exchange of information only on request. And as I said earlier when we did the preliminary, it's not the ultimate solution, Chair, but it's a step in the right direction in that it at least now enables us to get information on request from these jurisdictions where in the past they would simply have ignored you because there was no legal basis for the exchange of information. And not only that, but they had bank secrecy laws which denied them the power to give you that information, even if they'd wanted to. So, with all of these countries, as we stressed at the time, it's now finally given us the opportunity to be able to say to these countries, in relation to our taxpayers, we need this information. Can you confirm this? Can you confirm bank account? Whatever. And they will give it to us. And equally, they are part of the Global Forum membership. They're equally under pressure in peer reviews to ensure that nothing in their laws will stop them from getting the information which they've obliged to give under this particular agreement, limited by request. And that, as I've said, is the first step. All six of these agreements, Chair, are extremely similar. They're the first batch of the agreements which have been signed in both countries. Coming from the briefing which we gave to the committee, I think it was last year, and we're very happy at the progress we're starting to make in bringing these to ratification, because now we can do our best to make them operate. And operation is what it's all about for SARS. So I don't know if you want me to go back through all the provisions again, or perhaps just give you an outline of one of them, because they're all virtually the same. So I'm happy to do that, but up to you, Chair.
Okay. Honourable members, we have received these presentations before during the preliminary engagements with National Treasury. But if we want them to refresh our minds, we can do that with one of the protocols, not all of them. Refresher presentation.
Okay, I will just move for just one refresher, because they're all the same, eh?
Okay. All right. Mr. Ron, if you can deal with one so that you remind us of those issues.
With pleasure, Chair. I think the first one in the slides is Guernsey. And on something totally unrelated, Chair, I have also some admiration for Guernsey, because it was the first of these jurisdictions which agreed to do a multi-party negotiation with the SADC member states last month. And they came out to South Africa and they negotiated similar agreements with six other Southern African countries. And it was the first such negotiation for those six African countries, Southern African countries, which gives them also this access to information. So I tip my hat to Guernsey in being willing to do that. This is the tier with Guernsey. Article 1 provides that the exchange of information that is foreseeably relevant to the enforcement of the domestic laws of the parties concerning taxes covered by the agreement. It includes information that is foreseeably relevant to the determination, assessment, enforcement or collection of tax with respect to persons subject to such taxes, or to investigation of tax matters or the prosecution of criminal tax matters in relation to such persons. And this is important. The requested party, shall ensure that effective exchange of information is not unduly prevented or delayed. So in other words, you have to use all the powers of the law at your disposal to give that information to the requesting party. Article 2 deals with taxes covered. This is in line with the OECD model and in relation to Guernsey, extends to exchanges on taxes of every kind and description, so it's very comprehensive. Article 4, exchange of information upon request. Information should be exchanged without regard to a domestic tax interest under A, or whether the conduct being investigated would constitute a crime under the laws of the requested party. In other words, there should not be a test of dual criminality. Something might be a criminal offence under my law. If I ask for that information from you, it might not be a criminal offence in your country. That doesn't matter. You still have to give the information. Domestic law should also allow for exchange of any information held by banks, other financial institutions, and any person, including nominees and trustees, acting in an agency or fiduciary capacity. Secondly, information regarding the legal and beneficial ownership of companies, partnerships, foundations, and any other persons, including, in the case of collective investment schemes, information on shares, units, and other interests, and in the case of trusts, information on settlors, trustees, and beneficiaries. It does not create an obligation for a party to obtain or provide ownership information with respect to publicly traded companies or public collective investment schemes unless they can get that information without giving rise to disproportionate difficulties. Often you would say, well, why are you asking for the ownership information of a publicly traded company when all you have to do is Google it and you'll see all those details? Tax examinations abroad is dealt with under Article 5. It allows for representatives of the competent authority of the requesting party to enter the territory of the requested party, but only to the extent permitted under its domestic laws. It allows for the presence of those visiting officials at interviews which are conducted by the requested party, and everything which is done here is subject to the approval of the requested party. which is a fairly normal approach. Article 6, possibility of declining a request. The competent authority may decline to assist where the disclosure of the information requested would be contrary to public policy of the requested party. The agreement also does not impose any obligation to provide items which are subject to legal privilege or any trade, business, industrial, commercial, or professional secret or trade process. Once again, a very normal approach. And then finally, it touches on reciprocity. And it says there's no obligation to supply information which the requesting party would not itself be able to supply. Now that's important for us, and we're happily in a position that we would have no barriers to supply information ourselves. Therefore, they cannot turn around and say no reciprocity. We would be able to meet those tests of reciprocity. Article 7 deals with confidentiality, which is vital, of course, in our whole process. And it says that all information provided and received by the competent authorities of the parties shall be kept confidential. Information received shall be disclosed only to persons or authorities, including courts and administrative bodies, concerned with the purposes specified in Article 1. And that's dealing with the assessment and the whole appeal, etc., determination procedure in relation to tax. Information received may not be used for any purpose other than for the purposes stated in Article 1 without express written consent of the requested party. Now, Chair, that guarantee of confidentiality is exactly the same as that which we use in our double taxation agreements anyway. I don't have to say that we're all bound by oath of secrecy, but Section 108, which allows us to enter into these agreements of the Income Tax Act, specifically deals with the fact that nothing under the oath of secrecy will stop us from exchanging information with partners in international agreements, provided, of course, that confidentiality is maintained. Article 8 deals with costs. What we say is, unless the parties otherwise agree, indirect costs incurred in providing assistance shall be borne by the requested party. Direct costs shall be borne by the requesting party. And the requesting party should be notified if the costs are expected to be significant. In relation to those costs, we're looking at possibilities where, if I've gone along to, well, in this case, Guernsey, and said I need this and this and this information, and they have difficulty in getting it from their taxpayer or their resident, maybe they would have to take the man to court and actually use legal representation to force that information. That would be a cost which would be more than indirect, and they would certainly, in a case like that, say, look, this is the process we have to follow. It's going to cost this much. Do you still want to go ahead? And then we would need to decide whether the benefits don't outweigh the costs of getting that information. Article 9, dealing with mutual agreement procedure. That's a simple article which simply says, were there any difficulties relating to the implementation or interpretation of this agreement, then the respective competent authorities should use their best efforts to resolve the matter by mutual agreement. And then finally, in this tier, there's a mutual assistance procedure which says that if the competent authorities of the parties consider it appropriate to do so, they may agree to exchange technical know-how, develop new audit techniques, identify new areas of non-compliance, and jointly study non-compliance areas. That might sound strange coming from a jurisdiction which probably doesn't have tax as its main focus, but I can assure you that they also have tax departments who are faced in some respects with similar challenges to which SARS is faced, and therefore sometimes the exchange of more than information, but these techniques and identifying new areas of non-compliance is an interesting and helpful area. That's the treaty with Guernsey, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, comments? Honourable Sam Royan.
Thank you, Chair. I hear Mr. Van Merwe citing that on the issue of determination of cost, either direct or indirect, they negotiate with the requested party. So what I want to know is, does this imply it's on the case-by-case basis, or there is, it's decided as part of this agreement to say these are indirect costs and these are direct costs that can be incurred by either party? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In reply to the Honourable Member's question, I would say that what happens is that the competent authorities, which would be the Guernsey Tax Department and the Commissioner SARS, what we do in practical terms is have a simple memorandum of understanding which says these were, for argument's sake, any of your normal indirect costs you bear yourself in getting this information. But it would then give some examples of what would be considered direct costs. And I gave one example of having to bring in outside legal assistance, a translation of documents. If, for argument's sake, you're going to a bank and asking for information, and the bank says, yes, but to make copies of this, it's a pile of documentation, it's going to cost so much, those costs would be part of direct costs. And then they would come back to us and say, well, this is what it's going to cost. And we then have to make a call. If in relation to that information we're expecting to bring in a lot of tax, probably worthwhile. But those kind of practical issues would be done on a case-by-case approach, as you correctly point out. And there's just a practical MOU between the two competent authorities which would help them decide on these issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Matt Lemming.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I'm just going to request, it's not even a request, I'm just wondering, Chair. Out of so many, I mean, Guernsey, all those countries, for us to go to such an extent of a establishing these protocols for the exchange of information, what value is it adding to us?
Yes, Mr. Ross.
I think we need to look at it on this basis that in relation to the negotiation of at least these tiers, we do it electronically. So the cost of negotiation is minimal. The benefit is possibly immeasurable because it doesn't help that you sit in a situation one day and you say, wow, I need information from such a jurisdiction now in relation to this taxpayer. If you don't have a tier, you're not going to get it. And it doesn't help at that stage to start negotiating because it's going to take you time to put it in place. So our approach is, we need a foundation of these tiers with as many of the likely jurisdictions as we can so that when we need to use them, we can. And if I can refer to the one I've just dealt with, it played a vital part, or it is going to play a vital part, in one of the biggest court cases we've had dealing with tax avoidance. And if we not had these exchange of information provisions in some of our treaties and not updated them, and I refer here to the UK, which is a neighbour of, well, more than a neighbour of Guernsey, we simply would not have been successful in a case which brought us billions. And if I considered just that one, then if I spend 100,000 now in getting this foundation done, then it's worthwhile. The benefits are immeasurable. At the end of the day, in relation to the question, and it's a fair question, it's a tool. The benefit of the tool is in how well you use it. And we as an organization, I think it's been brought home to us, as it has the rest of the world in the last 2 years, that you ignore exchange of information at your peril, because that gives you access to many billions. If you look at the Americans, that the US, they, for argument's sake, say that there are trillions of dollars which their citizens have invested in offshore jurisdictions. They want to know about it. There was a report in the paper this week in relation to that, where a U.S. senator was demanding that the U.S. authorities should also create this good foundation to be able to get this information for their residents who are putting money offshore, if I could put it in broad terms. So for us at SARS, I think it's a question of vital importance, Chair, that we have this broad foundation of jurisdictions where we need information, we can go there immediately. We don't then have to start negotiating, because that takes time, although it doesn't cost much, because we can do it electronically. There are no taxing rights involved, etc. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any further comments, honourable members? None. Honourable members, so far we have received two sets of presentations on the proposed protocols. And as you are all aware, these are not new matters in this committee. We have dealt with this previously and engaged National Treasury and SARS thoroughly on these issues. We made our inputs then. And from where I'm sitting, looking at the presentations, I did not see any fundamental changes from what we discussed previously. I just want to check from honourable members if there are any further issues that they want the committee to further engage before we can adopt these proposals. Do we still need more time to engage on these issues, or are we comfortable with the presentations from both National Treasury and SARS? Yebo, Honourable Mthethwa.
Chair, thanks, Chair. I just want to ask how many more that are still outstanding besides this one that you presented to us last time?
National Treasury.
Sorry, is that the TIAs or the DTAs? The TIAs. In reply to that, we have the 6 for formal ratification. There's another 3 which are exactly the same, which we are putting in front of the committee today for preliminary hearing. And there's probably another 5 or 6 that we're still in the process of negotiating. Some, I think it's fair to say, of more importance to us, more priority to us, but as I say, it's the process, Chair, of creating that wide foundation so that when you need something, it's there to be used. But at this stage, 6 plus 3 plus about another 6 which are still under negotiation.
So it's 6 that is under negotiation that still has to come to before this committee. Is it in the next financial year?
It would probably be next year sometime. But they're still busy with negotiation.
Okay. Are you answered? Okay. Thank you, honourable members.
Okay. Yes, the figure that we have just given, that doesn't imply that it's a static process, or maybe it's a given number, because as a need arises, there might be other additional calls, I mean, that we need to enter into visit. That's my understanding. So, really, to me, it's a work in progress.
Yes. Hence, I was asking whether for this financial year or the outer years. Honorable members, if we do not have any further comments on these issues, I would like to ask the House that we break for 5 or 7 minutes, get some coffee, and come back for further presentations. Is it accepted? Thank you.